majority of citizens who are Afro-Venezuelans will have a report from the ground. And D.C. residents will elect their mayor in November. Will big business win out again? Or is the city ready for a democratic socialist? We'll speak with the candidate who believes they are. Good morning. Good morning and welcome to What's at Stake. I am Verna Avery Brown. Well, this year we'll host the 14th mayoral election in D.C. since Home Rule was passed in 1973. There have been six mayors elected to what was most famously known as Chocolate City when the black population made up 71.1% of the 700,000 plus population. In recent years, the population has expanded to 702,000 and the black population has shrunk to roughly 43%. Chocolate City has officially become Mocha City, with the white latte drinking population somewhere in the neighborhood of 39.1%. Those figures are from extended estimates of the 2020 Census Bureau, as reported by Perplexity. In November, D.C. residents will decide whether their next mayor should be one who continues the trend towards big business and development of the city, or if it's time for a different approach. The field of candidates is crowded. Election trackers indicate at least eight people are actively running or have filed, but the number can change if and when others decide to toss their hat in the ring. Mayor Muriel Bowser has not said publicly if she will seek a fourth term, but there's speculation that big business and development of the city, or if it's time for a different approach. There's speculation that big business is courting her to run again. Meanwhile, two city council members are considering pursuing the office: Ward 4 council member Janice Lewis George and at-large council member Kenyon McDuffie. Ward 4 council member Lewis George defines herself as a people first candidate, a democratic socialist. She's our guest this morning on What's at Stake. Good morning, council member Janice Lewis George. Thank you for joining us on What's at Stake.
Good morning. I'm so honored to be here with you.
Well, you know, I read where you are a third generation Washingtonian, born and raised and educated here. And of course, you're a Ward 4 city council member. But what about your early days? Where were you born? Columbia Hospital for Women, like many of us were? Or what was high school? What high school did you attend? Give us a little background on.
I'm proud Washingtonian. I grew up on Kennedy Street in Ward 4. I was born at Howard University Hospital. Proudly. Yeah, that's right. Really proud. Born at Howard University Hospital.
And of course, you have a law degree from Howard University.
That's right. That's right. So I tell people all the time, like when I say HU, you know, I want people to know, I mean, from the time I was born through my matriculation in education. And I went to all DC public schools. I really had so many amazing DC public school teachers. I went to Rudolph Elementary. I went to Alice Deal, where my grandmother actually served as a lunch lady for a number of decades. And graduated from the School Without Walls senior high school. So go Penguins.
Oh, okay. I have a son that attended the School Without Walls.
Oh, wonderful. Another Penguin.
Yeah. So tell us, why do you want to be mayor of the city that raised you?
Yeah, you know, I feel strongly that the district must work for everyone, you know, not just big business, not just the well-connected, but for all of us. And I feel strongly that we have to get to a space where we are putting people first. We have spent a lot of money investing at the top, giving money to developers and big businesses, and with the hope and the guise that somehow it's going to trickle down to the people. It's not trickling, and it's not going to trickle. And so for me, if we invest in the people, right? If you invest in our people, you invest in our communities, and you invest in our young people, if you invest in our small businesses, watch the ways in which they grow our economy, the ways they will grow our community. And I think that deserves a different approach, right? We can't rely on the market to provide affordable housing alone. We have to get aggressive about creating affordable housing in this city. We got to get aggressive about creating workforce housing so people who work in this city, our frontline workers, can afford to live in this city. And that takes intentional work. You can't just rely on the market to make it happen or give it to developers and hope that they will create it, because they're going to have profit at the center of that. And we have to have housing as a human right, housing as a public good at the center of creating affordable housing, right? You know, for me, it really is about the fact that we as a city, you know, growing up here, I have seen, right, my family, I remember coming back from a college to attend law school and being faced with the news. My mom, who's a U.S. postal worker, you know, couldn't afford to stay in the house that I grew up any longer because the rent had gone up several times, right? And so we as a city have gotten to a place where everyday people can't afford to be here. And I grew up in a neighborhood on Kennedy Street where we cared for one another and we fought for one another. And so we got to go get back to some of the basics, where we understand that housing is a public good, education is a public good, and we got to make sure all of our young people, no matter where they live in the city, has access to good education and educational opportunities. We got to open the doors of education and expand our vocational education programs again, get people back in the trades, right? Create opportunity for people. People want jobs. People want housing. They want good education. They want to feel safe in their community. And I feel strongly, with bold leadership and moral clarity, we can get it done. And I'm ready to get it done.
Well, now, Ned Bowser hasn't said definitively whether she intends to seek a fourth term. And Kenyon McDuffie, who is openly considering running, has not officially announced. But either way, both of them are pro-business development candidates that you'll be running against. And your platform is that of a democratic socialist. Mm-hmm. What precisely does that mean? Because the word socialist sometimes scares people that aren't really familiar. Will big business projects be put on hold? Will development in the city be stalled? What is a democratic socialist in the eyes of Janice Lewis George?
Yeah, I think it's a great question, because I think people keep framing it as like, oh, one's a pro-business and one it isn't. You know, I am pro-business. I'm going to support our businesses, but I'm going to invest in our small business and expanding them. But when we talk about democratic socialists, you know, I'm a member of our Metro DSA here in DC. I'm also a lifelong Democrat. And, you know, DSA members are the people who I've worked with to support tenants and helps hold slumlords accountable. And I also believe in the solutions grounded in helping people live to their full potential, like universal childcare and healthcare, right? These aren't radical terms. You know, who else was a democratic socialist? Because it's coming up. We're in January, right? Martin Luther King Jr., who famously said, right, in America, we all too often have socialism for the rich and rugged free enterprise capitalism for the poor, right? MLK believed, just like I believe, that there must be a better distribution of wealth in this country and in this city. And so for me, that's the same thing. I believe we got to have a better distribution of wealth. We have to invest in our people and watch the ways in investing in our people will grow our community. And I understand that our city, our government will work better if we have housing for our nurses and our social workers and our teachers and our transit workers and police officers, right? I understand that our government will work better if people feel like they can afford childcare and they have a place they can send their children to school to be educated, right? So this isn't something radical, this idea that people need healthcare, that people deserve housing. And guess what? Every other, you know, democratic country across this in this world right now has basic needs like healthcare taken care of, have basic needs like education and childcare taken care of. So none of these are radical ideas, really. We got to get back to a space where we understand that taking care of our people and taking care of people's fundamental needs betters our society and betters our community. And the same goes here in DC. We'll better our DC when we take care and make sure basic needs are met.
Now, Janice, this is not the same Washington, D.C. that you and I grew up in. Roughly 43% of the district's population is Black, 43%. The chocolate city that Gil Scott-Heron sang about no longer exists. not only that, but the 2026 DC is economically bifurcated. It has a sizable high-income professional class, a substantial low-income population, and a comparatively thinner middle-income segment. Which population are you appealing to? Who are you hoping to serve as mayor?
I'm going to serve everyone because I, again, believe that you have to support all of these different populations, right? Because when I go in neighborhoods and some of the affluent neighborhoods and they complain to me and say, council member, you know, I'm upset that, you know, my bus isn't coming frequently, or my trash isn't getting picked up on time, or my recycling isn't there, or why don't we have our nurses in schools? My answer to them is, you know why? Because we have to support our working class families. We got to give them the supports they need to create workforce housing and things, right? The more people who live in the city and invested in the city, the better city services are for everyone, right? And so it's not this idea that sort of I'm going to serve one group. As Ward 4 council member, as you know, we have such a, you know, diverse ward. I've served every single neighborhood. And the reason why is because I believe fundamentally that everyone in DC, no matter where you are, deserves the opportunity to have good government services and to have a city that thrives. And when I'm talking to neighbors and knocking doors in affluent neighborhoods, they're saying to me, council member, please take care of the people who run this city. We want to see them do well. That's why when my first year in office, we raised taxes on the top 1% through the Homes and Hearts Amendment. And that went to pay our childcare workers a fair wage or our pay equity fund. We did earned income tax credit, which put $1,000 in the pockets of working families every month. And we created more housing vouchers so families could have a place to stay in the city. And people were saying, thank you for doing that. That's where I want my money to go, to invest in having a working class in this city that can support this city and allow for government to work for all of us.
So Mayor Bowser has been elected 3 times with her pro-business development agenda. Her numbers are in the last election slipped about 1.5 percentage points, but she's still gone to 74.62% of the vote. DC is very gentrified now in 2026. What percentage of the population would you say your democratic socialist platform speaks to? And are they the percentage of the population that actually vote? Can affordable housing and development coexist?
Absolutely. I think what I'm speaking to, a government that works for all of us, speaks to the entire city. And I believe that everyone understands sort of how if meeting the basic needs of everyone in our community helps everyone overall. And my housing platform is about not just using, you know, working with developers. We have a ton of affordable housing developers in the city who do great work creating and building affordable housing in this city. And they've said to me, Councilmember, let's get more innovative. Let's get bolder. Right. And so, you know, I'm going to be working with everyone as I've done in Ward 4 now to create more affordable housing here across the city. And so, you know, I believe when I'm talking to neighbors in all 8 wards, I spent a couple of months before deciding to run for mayor, just going to every neighborhood and saying, what's working for you and what isn't working, right? And people felt and understood. They hated the fact that Ward 3 had 18 grocery stores and East of the River only had 3 or 4 that they could count and it's been inconsistent. They wanted to see me say, I'm going to fight and make sure there are grocery stores in all parts of this city and in food deserts, right? Right. So we have some really shared values as a city. Yes, gentrification has happened. But when I'm talking to neighbors of all backgrounds, whether you are a newcomer to the city or whether you're a third generation Washingtonian, everyone sort of understands some basic needs. We got to invest in our young people. We talk about our young people, but let's bring back our jobs and our after school programs and our before school programs. Right. Councilmember, can you make sure we take care of our young people so we don't have them doing negative things in our community? I hear that in all 8 wards. You know, council member, provide jobs and good wages for people, you know, and that's why I fought for the tip minimum wage. It's why I fought for and have labor behind me, is because labor understands that I've been with them toe to toe, making sure that we are creating jobs in this city. And I think that's, you know, and I've worked, to get deals for the city, just the most recent RFK deal. I fought to the last minute, you know, some of my opponents and were ready to accept, you know, the deal on day one. I said, oh, no, we're going to get the best deal for for the Commanders returning home and the stadium at RFK, and not just the stadium, but the development around the stadium. We fought to make sure we had affordable housing goals, we had environmental protections, but most importantly, we did ensuring that we had labor peace agreements and labor project agreements, and so that the hotels that will be built, anything, the development being built will be done by labor and include labor jobs. More than 51% of those labor jobs have to be district residents, right? So it's about opening the doors of opportunity. That's what I remember as a DC resident. One reason people love Marion Barry is because guess what? I'm a summer youth employment kid. I got my first job through Marion Barry. And that's the kind of mayor I want to be. I want people to say, I got my first house because Janice Lewis George fought for me. I got my first opportunity at an internship because she created opportunities. I want to do that same work, right? Transform people's lives. A robust working class is better for the entire city. And I believe it's possible.
So now, Save for Neighborhoods is a primary part of your platform. Mm-hmm. Yet you were the only one to vote against extending the police chief's authority to designate youth curfew zones, a measure I suppose was intended to keep the youth off the streets after a certain hour. Is that a contradiction in what you say you want to accomplish regarding safer neighborhoods, Janice?
No, I absolutely not. You know, I've spent my years, as a juvenile, working in youth prosecution as an attorney general, as a district attorney. And I am, you know, very helping on us using evidence-based approaches that work. And time again, the data tells us that youth curfews do not work. But more importantly, in this moment, you know, as Ward 4 council member, I've seen with the federal interference, I have seen ICE agents and federal law enforcement agents terrorizing our community by kidnapping neighbors off the street, taking parents away from their children, using anything to sort of have interactions. And so I felt in this moment that we should not be adding any additional tools while we have law enforcement that is in corroboration right now with the administration that is literally leaving our young people vulnerable to interactions, right? If we're going to have a safe community, our young people and generations have to trust the law enforcement, and the interactions that have been happening have deteriorated that trust. I believe we could find a way to help our young people by offering them alternatives, right? And we've done that. When there were young people meetups, instead of them having it, there was supposed to be one on U Street. We called the young people, we called the people on the ground, our Black Swan Academy and so many nonprofits, and we created an alternative. Instead of going here, come here, and we're going to provide a space for you to listen to music, a space for you to have a good time and interact with each other. So, you know, for me, a safe community is one that is invested in. A safe community is one that does the work of prevention and intervention work. And our young people deserve to have a future, to have a trust with their government. And especially at this moment where young people are being taken and their families are being taken by ICE.
Well, now, you live in Ward 4, where the crime is likely in the middle of the low, where the rate is likely much higher. Some residents in that part of town are hoping for stricter policing. Maybe they want some curfews, and some have even said they welcome the presence of the National Guard troops roaming. How do you adjust your policies to meet those concerns?
You know, I tell people what people want. Overall, the goal that people want is to not only be safe, but to feel safe, right? That's what everybody wants. And what I say to people is that we can do things to make sure our community is safe, right? They're doing it in Baltimore right now. I was listening to the Baltimore mayor, and he invested heavily in intervention and prevention work, and he used and work with law enforcement to do strategies that actually work to reduce crime. I tell people, you know, I served as a prosecutor. I have had to deal with and deal with the most heinous cases. And I had to deal with mothers who have lost their children. And I've also experienced what gun violence has had on our community as a young person in this city who've lost people to gun violence. I am going to fight to make our city safer by using the approaches that we know work. They're working in other cities like Baltimore and Chicago. Chicago. They're working across this city, and we have the means to do that. And so for me, it's important that they understand that we are going to take a holistic approach. We're going to focus on enforcement. There's so many things we can do. Having a crime lab that is accredited, having an OUC, Unified Communications, that works, fixing some of the broken things within our enforcement nexus that doesn't allow us to close cases and doesn't allow us to do the swift, to have swift prosecution and accountability that's necessary for us to deter crime. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to be focused on all of those things. And I've done that as a career prosecutor, but I've also done it as a council member in Ward 4 and across the city.
Ward 4 council member attorney Janice Lewis-George, former assistant attorney under Carl Racine, twice elected decisively to the Ward 4 seat, wife and mother and third generation Washingtonian, and mayoral candidate in 2026. Thank you for joining us this morning on What's at Stake.
Thank you so much.
And it is Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro remains in jail in New York. Members of his administration remain in control of their country. Trump allowed Maduro's vice president, Delcy Rodriguez, to assume control. Meanwhile, most opposition leaders, including the Nobel Peace Prize winner, Maria Corina Machado, are in exile or prison. The irrational actions on the part of the Donald Trump administration, according to one TikTok analyst, has less to do with Maduro than he's led the world to believe. Let's take a listen.
What happened in Venezuela today was not a political operation. It was not about human rights. It was not even really about Nicolás Maduro. It was a margin call. To understand why the United States just took the extreme risk of launching a military operation in South America, you do not need to look at the polls or the Constitution. You need to look at a much more boring, much more terrifying chart: the United States Strategic Petroleum Reserve. For the last 3 years, the United States has been draining its emergency oil tanks to artificially lower the price of gas. They have been selling the family silver to pay the rent. The reserve is now at its lowest level since the 1980s. At the same time, the petrodollar, the system that forces the world to buy oil in US currency, is on life support. Saudi Arabia has refused to renew its exclusive agreement. The BRICS nations are trading energy in yuan and local currencies. The exorbitant privilege of the dollar is evaporating. And then, last week, rumors began to circulate in the financial capitals. Rumors that Venezuela, the country with the largest proven oil reserves on the planet, was about to sign a definitive agreement to price its oil exclusively in a basket of BRICS currencies. That was the red line. The United States cannot afford to let the largest oil tank in the world disconnect from the dollar. If that happens, the demand for US Treasury bonds collapses, interest rates skyrocket, the entire debt-based economy of the West implodes.
So that's Kevin Thompson's podcast, Only One Sacawar, One Perspective. We should note, according to Perplexity, there is no credible public evidence that Venezuela was about to sign an oil agreement with BRICS. What is documented, however, is that Venezuela has long sought to deepen ties with non-U.S. partners as a way to circumvent U.S. sanctions. After this break, how is the abduction of Maduro going over in the Afro-Venezuelan community, which actually makes up the majority of the population? Back in a moment.
Peace and Happy New Year to all. This is your social justice calendar for the week of January 5th, 2026. On Thursday, January 8th, from 5 to 8 p.m., Rachel Needle hosts Charity Bingo Fundraiser, benefiting Food and Friends located on the second floor ballroom of Pinstripes on 11920 Grand Park Avenue, North Bethesda, Maryland. For more info, visit Facebook.com. On Sunday, January 11th, from 1 p.m. to 4 p.m., First Pakistan Global's annual tribute to independent journalism, exposing authoritarianism and human rights violations, Independent Media, presents Safeguarding Democracy and Human Rights. Discussion located at the Brookland Bus Boys and Poets location at 625 Monroe Street, Northeast, Washington, D.C. For more info and to RSVP, visit busboysandpoets.com. On Sunday, January 11th, from 7 to 9 p.m. at Sankofa Video Books and Cafe, there will be Haiti on Our Minds, a bi-weekly community gathering focusing on artistic expression and protest, located on 2714 Georgia Avenue, Northwest Washington, D.C. For more info, visit sankofa.com. WPFW's Social Justice Calendar connects you to grassroots activism in the DMV. Submissions can be emailed to socialjustice@wpfw.org. Please include the name, date, and address of the event. This is due by Thursday at 5 p.m., at least 1 week in advance of your event. WPFW's Social Justice Calendar helps build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
And welcome back to What's at Stake. I'm Verna Avery Brown, and joining me in this next segment is my esteemed colleague, Nefta Freeman, host of Voices with Vision. Nefta is a policy analyst with the Institute for Policy Studies and has traveled extensively to Venezuela over the past decade and has a firsthand perspective on how the Maduro administration has been regarded by the Afro-Venezuelans. Morning, Nefta. Thank you for agreeing to add your expertise to this discussion.
Thank you. Good morning. I just need to add that the more relevant affiliation I have is with the Black Alliance for Peace, which has the project Reject U.S. Imperialism, Make Our Americas a Zone of Peace, which deals with Venezuela and Haiti and all kind of things.
Okay, thank you for adding that. So also joining us is the People's Diplomacy Coordinator of the Youth of the Afro-Venezuelan National Cumbe, Chris Ortiz. Chris is joining us from Venezuela. Good morning to you, Chris, and it's an honor to have you join us this morning.
Chris. It's my honor to speak with you and for you to have the bravery to hear Venezuelan voices, Afro-Venezuelan voices. So thank you. That's why I'm here. Yes.
So, Chris, What's it like? What's the mood like in the Afro-Venezuelan community this morning?
Okay. Well, of course it's hard. About this morning, if we talk about Maduro, of course we're supporting fully. We're marching, we're protesting, we're in the streets. The streets are full every single day since the 3rd of January. But the states that were hit the most by the missiles are Afro-Venezuelan majority states. I live in Miranda, the most recognized black state of Venezuela. And right next to my home, more than 9 houses were completely destroyed. In Aragua, in the coast, most Afro-Venezuelans live in the coast. And the coast was heavily attacked. And so it's been hard. But at the same time, we fought for Maru Nash within that same logic. That's what we're doing. We're protesting. We're on the streets. And even though our sentiment is full of concern by a bomb falling near your house, it also gives us the strength to understand our legacy of Maru Nash. I think that's what you guys call it in English.
Well, Maru Nash is maroon resistance.
Yes, the maroon spirit of our ancestors to fight for this country, for our president.
So what are you protesting? What is the community's response to the fact that Donald Trump's administration actually abducted your president from a sovereign nation? Go ahead, Chris.
First and most importantly, we demand that the legitimate working class president Nicolás Maduro Moros and the first combatant Cilia Flores are returned to Venezuela. They are prisoners of war, and we are very clear in that. The Afro-Venezuelans are clear in that. We're going to have a huge meeting today of the constituent process to discuss that. That is our main demand. We demand Maduro to be returned back home to our motherland. Then, and secondly, we understand the danger for the Caribbean. We have a huge connection with the Afro-diaspora of all of the Caribbean, and we understand Venezuela is now the frontier from the empire to the rest of the continent of domination by the U.S. oligarchy. We believe in the U.S. people, and we believe in mass popular revolution. And we're fighting for the Afro-Venezuelan community to be protected, because the most affected community by missiles and by a Caribbean blockade is the Afro-Venezuelan fishermen, is the Afro-Venezuelan peasants, is the people in the coast. So we're fighting for them to get out of here. Or like some great singer would say, Ali Primera, Yankee, go home.
So, Chris, as I've been watching the coverage in the mainstream media of reactions to Trump's abduction of President Maduro, I noticed all the people interviewed were thrilled that Trump has abducted Maduro. They could now return home to their country that they had been prevented from returning to for decades, and their praises for Trump were just overflowing. Even the opposition leader sang Trump's praises and dedicated her Nobel Prize to him. But you operated within the Afro-Venezuelan community. What's the response been there? I mean, why?
The opposition leader, Maria Corina Machado, has a legacy of a family that owned slaves. I have no care for that person. I have no care for that person. I'm sorry that I get agitated, but a bomb was just dropped near my house. Okay? It was not nice. And this person has signed treaties with the Likud Israel political party. Israel. Maria Corina Machado is not a person to trust. And sadly, I believe in the Venezuelan people. And I understand migration is a hard issue. And but there's many truths. That, like, for example, it's not 8 million Venezuelans that went out of the country. It's not 8 million. That's not a true number. It was not that many. It was a lot of people, and most working class Venezuelan people that went out of the country have returned through the years, because here in Venezuela, we have a model of living that has been only getting better. As you can see in the CEPAL UN economic revision of 2025 and 2024, we've been growing more than 5%, the biggest economic growth of the whole region. Because we have been fighting for our sovereignty through communal production, through the production of new logics that have made our lives better. And the Afro-Venezuelans understand this deeply, because our communities were one of the most hit up by poverty. If you go to the main cities, I think you guys call it ghettos, here we say barrios. Most barrios in Venezuela are Afro-descendant. We were hit up by poverty thanks to the oligarchy of the Fourth Republic. But with Chavez, with Maduro, we started bringing policies to this community so we could get better. San Agustin is a great example of this. An Afro-Venezuelan barrio in Caracas that now has culture departments, a lot of money for the people, projects of art, almost no crime at all. Do we have issues as a country? Any country has issues. But we have a model for life, a model for commune, a model for socialism of the 21st century. So we Afro-Venezuelans that live here, that are the majority of people, because there's 30 million Venezuelans, 30 million Venezuelans in Venezuela. And most of us are against the U.S. imperialism.
Even so 30 million. What percentage of the Venezuelan population is African Venezuelan? What percentage would you
say? The recognized percentage by our National Institute of Statistics, the INES, is 54%. 54. And within that, the black communities are around 12%. We understand Afro-descendancy through the model of caste racism. I understand it's very different from segregation racism of the US. So it's a different kind of recognition of Afro-descendancy, I believe. But yes, 54% or 53% of our population is Afro-Venezuelan. And they recognize themselves. Black communities are around 14%. Indigenous communities 3%, and the rest is what we some people call it mestizos, some people call it Afro-Indigenous, and things of the sort. Yes, but it's majority of us.
So why is Maduro more popular or so popular among the Afro-Venezuelans? I mean, he's been described as, you know, national and internationally as a dictator, but you guys are calling for him to come back. Doesn't sound like you'd be calling for a dictator to come back. Why is he so popular?
Because here we believe in popular participative democracy. When my US comrades told me how you guys vote, I was terrified. We vote directly for that president here. We don't vote for some weird secret parliament and some electoral college stuff. And we really, like, Maduro recognizes himself as an Afro-Indigenous working class man. He came from a barrio, from one of the ghettos of Caracas that, as I said, are mostly Afro-Venezuelan. He came from Los Valles. He is a working class Afro-Venezuelan man. He doesn't come from an elite. And thanks to him, we have things like the Commission of Historical Truth for the revealing of decolonization. Thanks to him, we have the support of the National Council of Development of Afro-Venezuelan Communities, CONADECAFRO. Thanks to him, we have things like the LOPDRA, the National Law Against Racial Discrimination. Maduro has brought the Afro-Venezuelan people up, and not only the Afro-Venezuelan people, all of the people. That's the thing. He was the one that Chavez left in power because he understood. Chavez said, you need to vote for Maduro. Before Chavez was murdered, he said, you need to vote for Maduro because I trust this person to bring the project forward. And he has proven himself to do exactly that. That's why we want to turn.
Netfa, you wanted to add something to that.
Oh, yeah. Well, just, yeah, I think Christian's doing an excellent, I appreciate this analysis. I'm going to try to resist my temptation of start interviewing him and taking over your show.
We don't have to worry about that. We're not going to let that happen.
I can add, yeah. I think it's important for people to understand a few things, because the U.S. media here is so, in particular, the corporate media is so skewed. And so they will no more report the honest and understandings of what's happening in Venezuela any more than they will show our demonstrations against Palestine or something like that, you know. And so we can't really exist. And so and Nicolas Maduro and just the Bolivarian Revolution is not only popular with Afro-Venezuelans. It's a popular across the quote unquote race lines in Venezuela, and is a duly elected. Also, he can, or a Christian can talk about the election process here, where the government is unpopular. And these are the people who are exiled and coming to the United States are the elite classes who want to return Venezuela to neocolonialism. That's where the unpopularity is.
Okay. So presently, Maduro's administration remains in charge of the country, but Trump has said that he will run Venezuela. Are Venezuelans concerned, Chris, about Trump will eventually overthrow the remainder of the Maduro's administration and take charge of the country's oil, for example?
I think I want to analyze this from the perspective of Venezuelans. If you want to hear the official position of our country, go to Telesur English, go to VTV. But you know, in Venezuela, in the Afro diaspora, we never have drums of war. Our ancestors, the Yoruba, the Ifa, the Bantu people, they had drums of war. But when they came here with the Afro diaspora, with the Atlantic slave trade, we didn't have that. But the Afro Venezuelans, what we're scared of is that they attempt to invade this country because we're going to fight to the death for the project of this revolution. We're scared of initiating an issue because we know what we're going to do. When we say we're going to be the Latin American Vietnam, we mean it with our hearts. We believe in the Maroons. We are Maroons. We call ourselves Cimarrones.
Okay, so...
We believe that we have the capacity of President Maduro to be returned back. And we believe in the diplomatic capacity because he is still our president. And what we don't want is for Trump to allow himself to be oppressed as this fascist imperial force that we all know that's what he's turning into. That's why we're asking of your solidarity.
Yeah, it's not true that the U.S. put Delcy Rodriguez in power there or in ahead. She's denounced it. She's calling for the return of Maduro. She never said anything about, you know, and that it's important for people to understand, despite the U.S. declarations, the Venezuelan people are still in control of the government. Unfortunately, this means that this government was liable to do anything, and we hope that we can stop them from doing, you know, kind of the obliteration type of things they will do when they can't get control. But this whole psychological warfare that they're even doing against people in the U.S. to tell us that things are a different way. But the people in the streets, mass demonstrations and demanding the return of Maduro, and this is across, and just, they're not going to show that. They're not going to go to Venezuela and get on the ground and interview people there. And if they do, they're going to pick and choose and run around and find some elite class like they do here.
So, you know, why is it? I have seen the social media videos and reports where there are hundreds of thousands of appears to be Venezuelans in the street calling for the return of, you know, Maduro. But we don't ever see that in our media, as Netfa just explained why. Why is it we see very few people of color in the footage? Netfa, you were explaining earlier that race is perceived differently in Venezuela that it is, than it is in the U.S. Can you expound on that?
Mm-hmm. Well, this is a pretty big question. I'm going to have to do my short revision because this is what you call a thesis question. So largely is grounded in the it's a colonial situation of who was the colonizer, where in the United States comes out of British Anglo colonization, whereas in a lot of places in so-called Latin America, it's the Spanish, it's the Portuguese and French, and that the British, you know, had a caste system colonization. We all know the one drop rule, and if you got anything besides white, then you're a slave, and your children are born into slavery and all that. In Latin America, it was pretty different, and that as a result of this history, it was completely different. And you can even actually gain you can even be held office positions and things like that. And this is under colonial situations. And so the forms of neocolonialism are different. The perception of race was affected by this historical, this kind of material reality. And so what we might look here, and even how people look phenotypically, it's a more of a mixture. People lean more toward, having one or the other, or, like any place. But the decidedly black that we are told to identify here in the United States, so that person's as black, those kind of ideas aren't the same in Venezuela. So we might look at this crowd and see people who do not meet our standard as a majority of people is what we would call black. But in places in Latin America, that's not how people are seen.
So Maduro is actually Afro-Venezuelan that we're learning this morning. On this show. Is that accurate, Chris? I see you shaking your head.
100%.
Okay, so Netfa, what was your experience in Venezuela under Maduro? Was there fear among the population?
I have been in Venezuela many times, even under Chavez, so it's not just Maduro. I've been to Barlavento and the African communities and that process. There was no mass fear against what was going on. Of course, everyone's not completely, uniform in a particular politic, but I was able to see a lot of the projects, Barrio Adentro, which is the healthcare project where they're collaborating with Cuba to institute healthcare as a human right, polyclinics and all kind of things and training doctors, all of that. Been able to visit some of them. And in fact, I would like, it would be good for Christian to talk about the communes and different and how that commune projects help, where the communal areas are able to establish a lot of their own, what their own needs are with help from the state. So we went to one of the communes that had created their own complex, a living complex. They built it with their hands with, cement, state-of-the-art stuff, a nursery, infirmary, a place for all of the community to come and assemble so they can make decisions. And they were very proud of it. And that the state provides the grants, where they would have grants. And Christian could probably describe this better than me, how they would put in a requisition for that. There's so many things, all of the, and he can talk about the history, how the history, historical, teachings, education system around Afro, descendancy and whatnot is a human right. And there's a ministry, dedicated or designated to ensure that. And so, there's a lot going on in Venezuela. It's hosted a number of international forums, like the Sao Paulo Forum, and then the Afro Descendientes conference I went to in 2019 or so, where people came from all around the world, Africa, everywhere, to talk about the interests of Africa. It was basically a Pan-African conference, but they went, and a lot of people from Latin America, they were considered, they considered some Afro-Latinos. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, Venezuela hosted this, you know, and you know, yeah, and had a whole number of things, but yeah, I don't know if that answers your question.
It does. But now, Chris, so I want to know, what is actually happening on the ground now in Venezuela? Is there mobilizing taking place in addition to the protests?
Yes, mobilization. That's the goal we have right now from our president in charge, Delcy Rodriguez, from the Mirror State, and from the popular base, is full-on mobilization, full-on unity, and for government to keep on functioning. So we just had the National Assembly. Today I'm going to the constituent process of Afro-Venezuelans, and I'm also going to my college, because we're going to discuss the national line of experimental colleges in Venezuela, which are actually decolonial. Thank you once again, Chavez and Maduro. We're also doing the every day. There's a different manifestation in all of the country, and they're full. Today is the communal sector manifestation. So all of us keeping communes are going, and we're going to fight for that. We're going to keep on fighting.
When you say fight for it, is the community armed? I mean, the U.S. has troops on the ground there in Venezuela, does it not? Are there troops?
There is no complete information. Our National Guard, the FAMBE, the Fuerza Armada Nacional Bolivariana, has not said anything about U.S. troops on the ground. Trump can say anything he wants, because he said Delcy Rodriguez was appointed by him, not true. He said there were troops on the ground. It is not confirmed by our National Guard. He's trying to build a cognitive war, and we cannot believe in it. We cannot believe in it, because that's what the empire does. That's what they try to do with Palestine. That's what they try to do with Haiti. That's what they try to do with Congo, and they will not do the same in Venezuela. We believe in what we see. And if you're asking if the people are armed, yes, there are armed popular collectives. There are. And we have trained, because we believe in, not in the Prussian military regime, we believe in CILIC, Military Popular Union.
So let's move.
I'm sorry. A good Pan-Africanist of ours, Amilcar Cabral, see. We're not armed military. We are militants with arms. Thank you.
Yeah, that's
all right. Does that satisfy your definition, Netflix? You want to be clear on that. So let's move to the oil issue. Venezuela has the largest oil reserve on the planet, about 300 plus billion barrels ahead of Saudi Arabia and Canada. But it's extra heavy crude oil, which is difficult and costly to extract and refine. And experts predict it will cost tens of billions of dollars to extract, and tens of years before it would be of any use to the U.S. How has Venezuela let its infrastructure get to be in such a state of disrepair? Chris.
Venezuela didn't run the infrastructure to the ground. It was the U.S. Commandant Hugo Rafael Chavez Frias had a plan of popular power for oil to be distributed through energy sovereignty for the whole region. Things like Petrocaribe, things like new type of treaties through the Mercosur, through the UNASUR. We're building an oil industry that was for the people, for energy sovereignty, in order to do the just transition that we need in energy matters for climate. That's what Chavez believed in. And he said it many times in the ONU, in the COPs. He said, we don't need to change the climate, we need to change the system. So he started changing the system of how he traded with oil. So then, in the year 2015, Barack Obama did the, orden judicial of Venezuela being an unusual and extraordinary threat. So then Trump in 2016 started doing sanctions that brought our capacity of processing to 100% of oil capacity of processing of Venezuela to 1%. We were developing our industry because we had nationalized our oil in 1976 before Chavez, but we were developing the industry now for the people and not for PDVSA, PDVSA, the petroleum oil company of Venezuela, to be a private company that sold its, I'm not going to say bad words, to the United States of America and empires. So then Chavez said, we need to build the oil industry of the people and bring the, all of the oil money to the Caribbean, to the Bronx, to Latin America. To, the first thing he did was travel through the OPEP, through Middle Eastern countries, when everyone told him, you cannot do that. You cannot do that. It's a dangerous area. He didn't care. He went there and he did the OPEP, the OPEP. Our oil industry was on its way to be a change for the world. And that's why they called us an unusual and extraordinary threat, and they destroyed our oil industry. And that's why now they want to invade us.
So you're saying Barack Obama actually put that in place, move forward with that, identifying Venezuela as a threat?
Yeah, 2015. It was under Barack Obama's administration, but as we know, U.S. oligarchs, they have been very well against any revolutionary process, regardless of the president. But what, yes, it was Obama's administration.
What U.S. oil company is operating in Venezuela now, if any?
We had, to my knowledge, we had business with Chevron. I think that's a U.S. company, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And the... I don't really know of any more. Of course, I'm not some oil engineer expert. I'm sure there's people with the capacity to explain it in its full complexity. It is a complex topic. But all Venezuelans have general knowledge of this because it is the biggest oil reserve in the world. Mm-hmm. But you have treaties with America to sell oil with the United States of America. But we had nationalized the production. And we sold the oil, but it was national sovereignty, and it is a national good of the people.
Do you know if there are any attempts now to try to actually mend the infrastructure?
Yes, of course. And we had been making it very well. Actually, just last year or 2 years ago, for the first time after all of the sanctions, we were able to start exporting gas, and we were able to start rebuilding all of the national gasoline infrastructure. And we were giving, for example, there's indigenous communes in Amazonas, beautiful communes of indigenous people, and they had been having issues with the gasoline for fishermen of the Orinoco River. And Chavez and Maduro said, okay, we need to fix this. They started building the infrastructure of the gasoline processing plants, and now they have subsidized gas for the fishermen of Amazonas, which are more than 7,000 fishermen with a bunch of motors. You know, we had been rebuilding step by step through the 14 economic motors that Maduro had designated for the Plan de la Patria, which is the plan of the motherland.
Not in the 2 or 3 minutes that we have left, did you have a question that you wanted Chris to respond to?
I think it'd be good if in 2 or 3 minutes, Christian, if you can maybe give us a summary of the movement of Afro-Venezuelans from the beginning of Chavez to now, like, you know, the achievements and the objectives.
Wow.
I'm sorry. 19- I know.
It's a lot. It's a lot because before Chavez, we barely had any rights. There was the law of vagos and maleantes, which is very similar to U.S. loitering from the Fourth Republic, where they would hunt Afro-Venezuelan people just for being Afro-Venezuelan, you know? And black communities were the most affected by this. In Curiepe, in Miranda, in the rivers, through chemistry industry. But Chavez said, okay, this cannot be anymore. And thanks to the 1999 constituent process, we had things like the ROA, the Organization of Afro-Venezuelan Network. We had things like La Mujer. Now we have things like experimental colleges for decolonization. We have a master's degree in decolonization, in decolonial thinking, and andragogy, Robinsonian andragogy. Thanks to Chavez, like I said, CONADECAFRO, all of these institutions that now support the Afro-Venezuelans. the Afro-Venezuelan movement is strong. Not only, it wasn't just like a Chavez thing. It was a thing of Chavez letting the people take power. So now our communities could build their cumbes. Our communities could withhold all of their rights to the standard that they deserved. Now we have quality of life. Now we have the opportunity to build culture as an integral part of the nation. And we're fighting for Afro-Venezuelans to have a whole chapter in the Constitution and for to be recognized in our Constitution. Just like indigenous people were recognized thanks to that process. We're fighting for that, and it is only possible within revolution. So many rights there. Camilo's history is huge, and I would need to talk a whole other show to explain it all, and it's all in this short 25 years of Bolivarian revolution in communal state in transition to socialism.
The People's Diplomacy Coordinator of the Youth of the Afro-Venezuelan National Cumbe, Chris Ortiz. Chris, thank you for joining us this morning. Let's stay in touch, and you please be safe. A special thanks to James Count Early for his assistance in coordinating this interview. Thank you to my colleague, Netfa Freeman, IPS policy analyst and host of Voices with Vision on WPFW. And that's going to do it for this week's edition of What's at Stake. Thanks to my engineer extraordinaire, Mike Nasella, and special production assistance to Lona Elias in the past. Next week, Kimon Freeman will be the host in our seat. You don't want to miss it. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Up next, Dr. Ife Williams, and Wake Up and Stay Woke. And in the words of the late Nelson Mandela, it always seems impossible until it's done. Ashe.
Inviting all D.C. hand dancers, Philly boppers, Chicago steppers, Carolina shaggers, and West Coast swingers. The Treehouse Dreamers venue offers dance music from Motown and more every Friday, 1 to 5 p.m. at 4722 14th Street Northwest. DJ Jam and Dave and other fine DJs provide an atmosphere offering seniors socialization while getting much-needed quality movement through familiar tunes and dance every Friday. Details at 301-922-4064. That's 301-922-4064. WPFW offering wellness through dance, one activity at a time.
Hi, this is Jim Byers, host of the Latin Flavor Classic Edition. For nearly five decades, support from listeners like you has kept WPFW's wheels rolling. In fact, the single largest category of donations comes from those who donate an unused car to the station. That's right, running or not. Even a car sitting idle that needs thousands of dollars in repairs can do wonders for WPFW. If you can't drive it, donate it. WPFW will get the proceeds, and you'll get a tax break. Go to WPFWFM.org or call 1-866-WPFW-CAR. That's 1-866-973-9227 for more information. Help WPFW continue building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Thank you for supporting WPFW. When you make a pledge, you'll receive a short survey with your receipt or on our website or in an upcoming e-blast. Please take a few moments to share your thoughts. Your feedback helps strengthen our programming, better serve our community, and keep WPFW strong. We truly value your voice.
Good news, family. You can now take WPFW everywhere you go with our brand new WPFW radio app. Stream Jazz and Justice live, listen to archived shows, view the program schedule and playlists, donate, and more, all right from your phone. Download the WPFW radio app today from Apple App or Google Play Stores. WPFW in your pocket. Jazz and Justice wherever you are.
On Monday, January 19th, 9 a.m. until midnight, WPFW presents Injustice Anywhere, honoring the Pan-Africanist MLK and Haiti, the first sovereign Black Republic. From 9 a.m. until noon, we examine the Pan-Africanist legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. From noon until midnight, we center Haiti, her history, triumphs, Troubles, and Culture. That's Injustice Anywhere, honoring the Pan-Africanist MLK and Haiti, the first sovereign Black Republic. Monday, January 19th, 9 a.m. until midnight. WPFW, Building a Better World, one broadcast at a time.
Across the country, books are being challenged, restricted, and removed. But stories still deserve to be heard. Social Art and Culture, along with Mid-Atlantic Arts, WPFW, We Act Radio, and Cozy Black Girl Book Club present Unbanned, an afternoon event centered on banned books, creative freedom, and the power of access to information. On Sunday, January 18th, MLK Holiday Weekend, at the historic Miracle Theater. The event begins with an expert panel led by WPFW Program Director Katia Stitt, followed by a screening of the documentary film Band Together. Unbanned brings educators, artists, and advocates together to discuss censorship and why banned books matter. Details at unbannedevent.eventbrite.com. That's unbannedevent.eventbrite.com.
I'm Muiza Muntali, host of African Now, and you're tuned to member-supported WPFW Washington.